Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Before and immediately after the 2016 presidential campaign, two of my guests tonight took to Twitter to share their concerns about the misogyny, hate speech, and racism which surfaced during the campaign. From an initial tweet, they each created nationally recognized movements, Grab Your Wallet and Sleeping Giants. The power and scope of these social media movements have energized their followers, yet critics have complained that they are unfairly targeting conservative views. Are boycotts and calls to take down advertising a form of censorship, or is this free speech at its best? Should corporations with their advertising dollars and pull be the one to decide which speech gets heard and which businesses survive? Tonight, I'm pleased to be joined by Shannon Coulter, a digital marketing specialist based here in San Francisco. Using the hashtag GrabYourWallet, Shannon called upon the public to boycott retailers which did business with Trump-affiliated businesses. Since its start in October 2016, the hashtag GrabYourWallet has had over 1 billion views, while Ivanka Trump has since shuttered her business. So welcome, Shannon.
Thank you.
And I'm also joined in the studio by Matt Rivets, a freelance copywriter who also turned to Twitter after the election to found Sleeping Giants, a group which encourages its followers to flag advertisers who are running ads on Breitbart, an alt-right website that was the former home of Trump advisor Steve Bannon. Since its founding, over 4,000 advertisers have stopped advertising on Breitbart. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And we're joined from the Northgate Studios at UC Berkeley School of Journalism by David Snyder. He's the executive director of the First Amendment Coalition, a nonprofit dedicated to advancing free speech. Both a lawyer and a journalist, David has been a reporter for the Dallas Morning News and Washington Post, among other publications, and with the firm Shepard Mullen. Welcome, David.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And we hope that you, of course, will be able to join us for the conversation. We're going to open our phone lines in just about 20 minutes. You can call in at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can also reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. We want to know what you think of Twitter activism. Have you participated in a boycott? Are conservative voices being unfairly targeted? You can send in your questions now, or as I say, we'll have the phone lines open in just 20 minutes. So, Shannon, let me start with you. What got you started with Grab Your Wallet? How did this come about?
Yeah, I was on Twitter late one night. This was shortly after the Access Hollywood tape had come out. And I was just, like many women, filled with rage and looking for something to do with that energy. I was not sleeping very well. I was having some bad memories about workplace experiences that I had gone through early in my career. And so I just started talking about the possibility of a boycott that night. And there was such a response to it immediately that I knew that there was something there. I found another woman online, that name named Sue Atencio, who joined me. We had never having met one another or spoken to one another. We just sort of banded together and announced that we were doing this. And it really took off. And since then, I think 44 companies have been dropped from the list. So a number of retailers that used to carry Trump products announced along the way that they no longer would. And of course, Ivanka, as you mentioned, has since shuttered her line. So it's been pretty successful.
And why a retail boycott? I mean, you could have taken this passion and energy and anger in multiple directions, but why that one?
It's true. So we have to remember at the time, the Trump campaign, you know, they were making campaign stops pretty much every night. And the way that a lot of people, including myself, felt about it was that the stores that we love doing business with, like Nordstrom has a very passionate customer base, were profiting from this campaign of hate, you know, a campaign that was equating Mexican people with rapists, you know, making fun of disabled people. It was at the center of this campaign was a guy who had questioned the nationality of the country's first black president for a five-year period. So every time they would make a campaign stop, Ivanka would go on her Instagram feed and market whatever look she had been sporting that night. So a lot of people were particularly troubled by the fact that there was this direct line between, you know, her dresses would sell out after a campaign stop. So they didn't want to do business with companies that were profiting from that kind of campaign. And then the other big thing that was happening was that, you know, a lot of women go shopping to relax and have fun, and they were going into stores that they loved and had shopped at for years and were encountering the name Trump in the retail environment where they were trying to relax and have fun, and it was upsetting and traumatic, and for some women, even bringing back memories of sexual assault. So
I want to ask you about the grab your wallet list that you just mentioned. So can you first tell me some of the companies that were on the list that have since moved off based on this activism?
Yeah, the three biggest wins of the companies that actually made formal announcements that they were dropping the Trump brand would be Nordstrom, Neiman Marcus, and Hudson's Bay, which is kind of like Canada's Nordstrom. And I think that Hudson's Bay was really the one that put it over the top with Ivanka deciding to shutter her line, because at the time, Trump was not especially not popular with Canadians. He had just imposed the tariffs on Canada. The border crisis had just come into the international media attention. So there was a lot of pressure. I mean, there had been a lot of pressure on Hudson's Bay up until that point. And there was even a great spinoff boycott called Baycott, where Canadian women were telling Hudson's Bay, look, we want you to drop this line. But that was, I think, the straw that broke the camel's back was the border crisis.
And right now, which companies are still on the list?
There's a range of companies. So there are companies that have either senior executive team members or board members who donated significantly to the Trump campaign. And that's a whole other conversation about whether or not it's okay to boycott based on that. Probably the most well-known one on the list right now that falls into that category is L.L. Bean. And that there was a big kerfluffle around that when that came into the spotlight.
And I have to ask, how did you feel that, you know, you played a potentially a big role in Ivanka Trump having to shutter her business? I mean, you're, you know, starting out as, you know, just like anyone else in the political process. And did you ever expect to have that kind of outcome?
I know it's going to sound crazy, but I actually did, because there was so much energy behind the initial, you know, talk about it. There were so many women feeling exactly the way that I was feeling, and it was very clear that I knew that it would have impact. I don't know if I ever imagined that it would end Ivanka Trump's line, but I knew that it would have impact.
And had you had any experience with these kinds of boycotts before, any kind of social media activism?
No, I've been pretty focused on my career for the last 25 plus years in San Francisco, so this was a brand new world to me.
All right, well, Matt, I want to turn to you. How did your Twitter activism began with Sleeping Giants?
Yeah, I mean, much in the same way I think Shannon did. I was just working my job in advertising, and after the election, Steve Bannon started becoming sort of more prominent, and he was in the spotlight a lot. And so, you know, Trump is one thing, but Bannon represented a lot to me about racism, and he was using racism as a chance to get more votes and all that stuff. And to me, that felt really wrong. I grew up learning from my parents that racism was a terrible thing, as a lot of people did. But I heard more about Breitbart and Breitbart News, and I was pretty interested in what I had never been there. I'd never been on the site before, and I didn't know. So I went to look at the site, and there were articles. There's a black crime tag for articles on the website that was just for crimes perpetrated by African Americans. And there were articles saying there's no hiring bias against women in tech. They just suck at interviews. And just really terrible articles across the board. And above all those articles were ads. And so I'm in advertising. I spend an awful lot of time with clients and trying to perfect, you know, every last word and to make sure that no one's offended by anything. So I was pretty shocked that they would then take some of those ads and then put them carelessly above, you know, some of these articles. And so the more I dug into it, the more I realized that these ads were being placed programmatically, which means Google and Facebook and a couple other companies were taking money. They would take an ad and then traffic it to all the sites on the internet, no matter where they are. Sometimes it was more targeted than others. But they would end up on these sites largely without their knowledge, without the customer's knowledge when they showed up there. So I just set up an anonymous Twitter handle and tweeted out. The first company I saw was SoFi, which is a progressive loan company from San Francisco. And I sent them a tweet from this anonymous account saying, hey, do you know your ad is on this site? And they got back within half an hour, the CEO did, and said I had no idea it was on there. And from there, I was completely blown away, because someone paid for this placement and they don't know they're on this site.
So it's kind of amazing to me that these corporate clients have no idea where their advertising dollars are going, where their brand is being associated.
Yeah.
Are there any screens at all?
There are now a little. I mean, there are definitely for the much bigger corporations and advertisers. They definitely have lists and they have people managing that. The only problem is the smaller and medium sized companies have no list, and so they give their money over to Google and Facebook and other companies, and they end up getting placed on there without their knowledge because Breitbart itself is actually on their ad network. When I started this thing, there were still ads being placed on Daily Stormer, which is like the biggest Nazi site on the internet. There was nothing stopping any site from monetizing themselves with some of these companies. So it was kind of a mystery to them that they would show up on there. So I started that, and then I put a set of instructions at the top of the Twitter handle and on my Twitter page, and everyone started doing the same thing I was doing, and they got the same amount of satisfaction when a company would get back to them and say, "Oh, we had no idea we were there. Oh my God, we don't want to have any association with that." So that's where it started, and we're sitting, almost 4,200 advertisers later.
So the big companies now, I imagine, are much more savvy about this. I don't want these kinds of public relations situations, I'm gathering. But it sounds like from the smaller companies, they can't afford to do that kind of due diligence necessarily. So are there efforts to try to put a screen in place, like for these Google services, where they can basically provide that service for a smaller company?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we're actually working on right now. I mean, it's not happening anytime soon, but we're certainly thinking along down those lines. But the problem is really that like Breitbart is still sitting on the ad networks on a lot of these ad networks, and so despite breaking their terms of service, they have very clear terms of service of what's allowed for ads, and they're still on there despite us saying, "Hey, look, here are your articles, here are the comment section." There are a lot of ways that this breaks your terms of service. How come it's still on there? But they're still sitting on there.
Mm-hmm. And I have to ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Shannon, why did you turn to Twitter in the first place, given other social media platforms?
Well, I think it's, Matt and I joke all the time that the internet was a mistake and that it's a terrible place and that all these terrible things happen to people because of the internet. But the thing that we don't talk about a lot is the democratizing effect that social media has had. I mean, some people have talked about it, but I read articles about how women and people of color were early adopters of social media, and I think there's a very, very clear reason for that. It's because in a lot of institutionalized settings, our voices don't always feel particularly heard. So social media was, I'm a social media professional, I'm a digital marketing professional, it was a natural place for me to turn. And when I experienced the response of so many women feeling the same way at the same time, it was really powerful. I've never seen a billion in any of my numbers for my entire career. I wouldn't have even believed that was possible.
And Matt, same question to you. What made you turn to Twitter?
There's actually a really specific reason. I had one experience with Twitter. I had a personal Twitter page, and I had maybe sent out 10 tweets in my life, and five of them were about football. I'm getting mad at my team. After that, someone had told me that if you tweet at a company, then there will be someone behind the Twitter handle that will get back to you right away. And so if you call or you drop an email, you might not hear back, and they have a really good chance to ignore you. But on social media, people need to answer you right away because it's a very public forum, especially Twitter, and people find out about things really quickly. So that seemed like a natural thing. I had been to IKEA once, and it was taking forever for a dresser to come out. And so I had just to see if it would work. I wrote to IKEA. I dropped them a tweet on my personal Twitter handle, and they got back like 10 minutes later, 5 minutes later. So that was the kernel of the idea that this would have only worked on Twitter. And we have a Facebook page too that's very effective, but Twitter is very quick and very public.
Yeah, I don't think it's an accident that the two people who've had a lot of impact working with companies on issues like this didn't come from the traditional nonprofit and activist world. We came from the corporate world, and we understand how brands think. We understand how much they care about their brands and how much effort they go to cultivate those brands. So I think we know where the pain points are a little bit better.
And Matt, I have to ask you, because I asked Shannon about some of the successes in terms of the companies that she influenced with Breitbart. Can you describe or list some of the companies that stopped advertising and what happened with Breitbart's site?
I would say the majority of them have. I mean, there was one really big one, Kellogg's. They were the first really big corporation to drop out from Breitbart, and that really caused a pretty big uproar. Breitbart did a counter boycott, which is really, I mean, if you're in marketing like we are, that was the dumbest thing they could have done, because who wants to advertise on a site that's going to turn around and boycott you if you leave? That just didn't really wash with a lot of advertisers and made our job a lot easier. But yeah, past Breitbart, we've done a lot of other things. And we've really asked, we've asked a lot of the social media platforms to take more responsibility about what's on their platform. And so there have been a lot of big wins there, because they've, we're just trying to get them to take some responsibility. And it's been pretty successful, all told, in the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm. It certainly sounds like it. Well, let me bring David Snyder into the conversation, the executive director of the First Amendment Coalition, basically here through the UC Berkeley School of Journalism. So, David, we're glad you can join us. Now, let me ask you, David, are these campaigns engaged in free speech, and where do you draw the line?
They're absolutely free speech, and they're a particularly interesting and, I think, powerful example of free speech, where I think the campaigns diverge from what you might consider classic protest campaigns, is that they directly bring advertising dollars to bear. So boycotts of companies are nothing new, and boycotts even of news organizations are not necessarily anything new. But these two campaigns, well, the Sleeping Giants in particular, because it's targeted a sort of news or information platform, are different because they have as one of their goals to at least alter and perhaps completely shut down a media platform. And so in a sense, that their goal is to censor, and it's not government censorship, so the First Amendment doesn't come into play, but it is censorship. And so I think it's important to think about and consider what that means and to go through an exercise of putting the shoe on the other foot. So here in the San Francisco Bay Area, it's unlikely that you're going to find very many people who are big proponents of Breitbart. But you probably would find a lot of people who are supporters of Mother Jones or The Nation. And if those publications came under a similar social media driven attack to their advertisers and their livelihoods were threatened, I think we might see some different reactions. The larger point that I think is important to keep in mind is that one of the animating principles that underlies the First Amendment is the concept of a marketplace of ideas. This is a sort of Enlightenment era idea whereby the body politic is able to come to the best solutions for a representative democracy by being exposed to the widest range possible of ideas. And so those ideas, included in those ideas, are the most abhorrent, offensive, ridiculous, faulty concepts. And the sort of ideal is that the body politic is able to weed through all of these and ultimately come to the right choice, whatever that right choice may be. Now, does the information marketplace actually function like that? I don't think it necessarily does, but I think it's a useful principle to keep in mind because it drove the founders' conception of what free expression was. And I think to this day, it informs court decisions on the First Amendment and free expression generally, the idea being that the best response to an idea that you disagree with is to not shut that speech down, to not close out that idea, but to attack it with more speech. And then the people get to decide whether they agree or disagree. And these campaigns are, as I said earlier, they're free expression. They're people expressing their views about a particular media platform in the case of Breitbart, or a particular politician and his family in the case of Trump, and that's all to the good. Where I think it gets a little bit interesting and perhaps problematic under the marketplace of ideas concept is where the goal becomes to actually silence somebody's speech. That is a goal that under the First Amendment and under the cases that have developed, the body of case law that's developed under the First Amendment, that isn't really tolerated under First Amendment jurisprudence. There's an idea of something called the heckler's veto, which is most easiest to conceive of if you put it in a physical space. So you have an auditorium where somebody is giving a presentation. Everyone in the audience has free speech rights, just like the person giving the presentation does, but the people in the audience don't have the First Amendment right to silence or shout down the person who's speaking in this auditorium. Do these campaigns, or does the Sleeping Giants campaign go over that line? I don't know, but I do think it's an interesting experiment, sort of thought experiment, to think through what the implications are for this approach for a publication that you agree with, for a publication that you think adds valuable contributions to the political discourse.
Well, lots of interesting issues certainly to talk about. I have a bunch of follow-up questions for you, but first I want to let our listeners know that this is City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Shannon Coulter, co-founder of Grab Your Wallet, Matt Rivets, founder of Sleeping Giants, and joining us from Northgate Studios at UC Berkeley School of Journalism, David Snyder, executive director of the First Amendment Coalition. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. Have you engaged in Twitter activism? Do you think boycotts are effective? The number to call to join this conversation is 1-866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. We'd love to hear your questions for our panel tonight. So, David, I want to go back to you just in reference to what you just described in terms of the difficulty of drawing lines, but also describing these efforts as essentially a form of censorship or potentially silencing speech, if I heard you correctly. But is it really silencing speech if you're still allowing someone to talk? You're just simply going after the microphone. That seems to me a different kind of a thing there. I mean, no one's being thrown in jail. No one's being told not to say something. It's just a matter of the vehicle with which they're saying something.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And actually, to take a couple of steps back and talk about the difference between the broad concept of free expression and the First Amendment, which, as everybody knows, protects free expression in the Constitution. The First Amendment only comes into play when government action is at issue. So the government is barred from censoring. The government is barred from discriminating based on viewpoint. And so there really isn't a First Amendment issue with these campaigns. You could imagine scenarios where it would come up, but as they are now, there really isn't a First Amendment issue. There is, though, I think, a free expression issue, and it is hard to draw the line. I totally agree with you that speech as a general matter, criticism as a general matter, doesn't amount to censorship. Where I think the line might be crossed, or at least we get close to the line, is where you're attacking the financial lifeblood of a particular media platform. So online platforms rely entirely on online advertising. They're unlike publications that have both a paper product and an online product where they can sell ads in the paper, they can sell classified ads in the paper, and they can also rely on online ads. When you go after online advertising for an online-only outlet, you're potentially cutting the knees out from under that online publication.
All right, so it's getting a little gray, I suppose, in how we compare free expression to free speech. But let's go to a caller who has a question along these lines. So I want to welcome Reihart, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, from San Francisco. Welcome to City Visions.
Hello, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Amazing, thanks for asking.
So what's your question?
I just wanted to say that I totally fundamentally disagree, and so would the Constitution, that Constitution always says Congress shall make no law to go under free speech. The crowd always has the right to shout down an Ann Coulter or someone that they don't disagree with. And I think whoever just said that's like an anti-free speech position, as speaking from a, position of privilege, who lives in a community who's never had to worry about someone coming to their town and preaching something that they want to boo and they want to shout down and not allow to happen. I also think that in the free marketplace of ideas, a business is always allowed to try to put another business out of business, be that by going after their ad base or whatever it might be. This is the market, So I think that all of these, ways that we're talking about limiting someone's ability to limit someone else's speech, that's the real, non-free speech.
Yeah, well, it's a great point. Let me let the panelists respond. And, David, I'll start with you since I think he's directly responding to what you just said. So why don't you take the first crack at this?
Sure. Shouting is absolutely protected free expression, and everyone is free under the First Amendment to protest speech to attack speech rhetorically, where it gets to the point that the speaker is actually prevented from speaking, depending on the context, that can give rise to problems under the First Amendment. So there's the heckler's veto concept that I talked about before. The First Amendment does not protect against otherwise criminal activity. So when you have a body of protesters who start breaking windows or punching people, the First Amendment doesn't protect those acts. And I'm not at all suggesting that what these social media campaigns are doing is anything akin to those. And I don't think that what they engage in is clearly censorship. I do think that there's an interesting line that it walks up to where the proposition is that the media platform with which we disagree ought to be closed down entirely. I think that raises issues regarding the marketplace of ideas. I don't think that it's not protected activity under the First Amendment, but I do think it gives rise to interesting implications and potentially problems with respect to the people having the broadest range of speech available to them.
All right. Well, let's let the other panelists here weigh in on this. So, Matt, you've heard David's perspective on this. What's our caller Reihard as well. What's your reaction?
Yeah, I mean it is definitely a debate that rages on our Twitter feed all the time, and there are a lot of people that are Breitbart fans or Alex Jones fans that feel like maybe it's censorship, but it is using our free speech, and it also, this is a brand new problem in a lot of ways because the internet has really done this. For a very long time, the ad networks allowed anyone to monetize, and they allowed anyone to say anything they wanted on their platforms for the most part. And they didn't start enforcing their terms of service until recently. And so a lot of the people that were able to pull in a lot of money saying whatever they wanted are all of a sudden really aggrieved because they don't have that all of a sudden. But it was never really their right to have it. These are private businesses. Google is a private business that sells ads. Any social platform is a business. And so we're asking businesses to take responsibility. And we're also asking advertisers if, number one, if they know that they're on this site. And number two, if it matches their brand and what they want to do with their brand. And the vast majority of them say no, that's not what they want. And so it's a really interesting debate, but we don't view it as censorship. Breitbart's still there. They're being funded by the Mercer family, and they're always going to be. And they're able to say whatever they want. It doesn't mean that they have the right to take money from advertisers that don't know that they're showing up there. And so it's a really different – it is. It's a new problem, and it's a new debate. But it's all done, you know, under the First Amendment. We're using our First Amendment rights to speak our minds. So are they. It's just – Who's gonna prevail in the end?
And you mentioned the Mercer family. Do you want to just for listeners who aren't familiar with the Mercers, describe who they are?
Yeah, Robert Mercer was co-CEO of Renaissance Technologies. He's a billionaire. His daughter Rebecca Mercer, she runs his foundation, and they pour a lot of money into a lot of different things. And one of them was Breitbart, and another one was Steve Bannon, and another one is Milo Yiannopoulos. All of whom are unsavory characters in my mind.
All right. Well, Shannon, let me give you an opportunity to weigh in on this issue, this debate.
Yeah, there's some great points that have been brought up both by Dave and the caller, I think. I'm a strong believer in the marketplace of ideas. I was a journalism major in the early part of my career. I did some journalism. I use the word ideas loosely when it comes to platforms like Breitbart and Daily Stormer because, frankly, a lot of what they publish is just outright fabrication. And I think that's the part of this that we aren't talking about. So with the marketplace of ideas, a really big question, as the caller pointed to, was who gets access to the marketplace of ideas? And when Alex Jones has a platform with millions, 5 million listeners every day, and he can go onto that platform and say that the Sandy Hook school shooting never happened, who does that harm? And who is the vulnerable person in that? And the parents of those kids who got killed that day are the ones who are in harm's way, directly in harm's way because of Alex Jones' free speech. And that's not an abstract First Amendment issue. That's a health and safety issue. So I think that, you know, I did a Twitter thing where we like did a group block of 80,000 people did a group block of Twitter's biggest advertisers to get Alex Jones off the platform. And a lot of free speech issues came up at that point. And my point was, if Alex Jones walked into a Nordstrom and started ranting about Sandy Hook being a myth and never having happened, Nordstrom would kick him out immediately. Twitter's a company too, and they have the right to do that too.
Well, and of course, there's been a lawsuit making the news about Alex Jones on the behalf of the Sandy Hook families, arguing that he is liable for damages now for spreading some of that misinformation. So the legal system is a check here. And actually, David, maybe if you want to just briefly weigh in on that case, if you've been following it at all since Shannon just mentioned Alex Jones.
Yeah, I have. And there's a really important distinction to make here, I think, that helps illustrate or elucidate what the free expression issues are. Twitter absolutely has the right, at least under the First Amendment, to ban whomever they want or to allow whomever they want. They're a private platform. And so efforts to persuade Twitter as a private entity that they should ban certain people are also free speech. Twitter can ban or not ban. Now, whether how that affects the marketplace of ideas is a separate question. Now, we're a court gets involved, then First Amendment protections come into play, because a court is a government it's an arm of the government. And so what a defamation plaintiff and what in this case the Sandy Hook families are seeking are damages, a court order finding that Alex Jones and InfoWars engaged in defamation. Mm-hmm. And so Alex Jones, though many if not most of the things that he says are false and outright fabrications, nonetheless is entitled to protection under the First Amendment. And so it'll be interesting to see where that case goes. Typically, the vast majority of cases that have arisen under the First Amendment in the defamation context are news outlets. I don't think anyone would describe InfoWars or Alex Jones as purveyors of journalism. And so it will be interesting to see how those cases turn out. Mm-hmm. But the, I think, important point to make is that because you've got government action there involved, i.e. the court ultimately may issue an order, the First Amendment applies to Alex Jones, and the plaintiffs therefore have to make a very difficult showing to make in court before they can be entitled to damages against Jones. And
so something to keep in mind as we're debating some of these issues in terms of those free speech protections and how it implicates government action. So I appreciate that summary. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Shannon Coulter, co-founder of Grab Your Wallet, Matt Rivets, founder of Sleeping Giants, and David Snyder, executive director of the First Amendment Coalition. We invite you to call in with questions or comments, and that number to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. The phone lines are open now. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page, and we'll read that and pick out a question if you have one that is related to the conversation here. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisionskalw. So let's see. I wanted to ask both Shannon and Mark, or Matt, excuse me. Both of you decided to do activism related to Twitter going after corporations, but you could have also been involved in the political process too in a different way. So I guess my question is, why look at corporations instead of trying to mobilize more around the political process?
Just speaking for me, I've never viewed Sleeping Giants as a political, any kind of political committee or action group. To me, it's always been about bigotry and racism and sexism and misogyny. So I don't think the politics should play into those things. And so I've opted to just keep this about that. I think that's the most important thing. These are sites. Any time that we've engaged with any sites, it's been for a really specific reason. It's ongoing. It's an ongoing engagement with racism. And so to me, that's what it's about. It's not about politics. I hate politics, so just personally. So I don't want to get involved in that stuff.
But do you worry about David's point that, you know, the shoe could be on the other foot, that maybe you don't like politics, but some outlets that, you know, that you might be sympathetic toward might now
That's why I don't worry about that stuff. Because to me, if a corporation should be making a call, if you believe in diversity and inclusion and you say that on your website and that means something to you, and you've got or you've got terms of service preventing that from happening on your platform, those are what cause you to take action. If someone just says something political, no one's going to react to that. That's not something that's going to move the needle at all.
Yeah.
This is all about racism and bigotry. And if you're a corporation, you want to have nothing to do with that. And that's been the why this thing has been successful, because it's been about that. It's not about politics. If it's just about politics, you know, that's just a war that no one wants to get into.
Yeah, I don't think the boycott ever would have happened. The Grab Your Wallet boycott never would have happened if Mitt Romney or Carly Fiorina had become president of the United States of America. It's not about Donald Trump being a Republican. It's about his fundamental lack of basic human decency and respect toward other people. And that, I 110% agree with Matt, is not a political issue. It's a basic human decency issue.
And do you believe that consumer activism can be more effective than other forms of protest? And
Shannon, well, I've talked a lot with people about how the kind of change that we asked companies for in this particular case isn't necessarily the change that we need in the world. Governments can make that kind of change. One person boycott, you know, with other people participating, can't necessarily. But the internet, I mean, another reason I think, I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth, Matt, if I say that, another reason I think that we have done what we've done is that this is our backyard. Tech is our backyard. We are San Francisco marketing and digital specialists, so we talk with these people every day and these brands every day, and we see the internet as a place, I see the internet as a place that is sorely in need of some discipline and like some rigor around ethics.
Agreed.
You know, I think that it's basically the wild, wild west still, and the first 20 years was building it, and now we've got to put some rules in place.
And Matt, same question for you in terms of consumer activism versus other types of protest.
It's one thing. I think it's a really different thing. I mean, even Shannon and I have really different ways of looking at things. I mean, she's done a boycott. I don't believe that Sleeping Giants is a boycott. We've never asked someone to not buy something from any of the advertisers that show up on one of these sites. I agree. I think right now, it's consumerism is what we have, is what regular people have, and that's how we can affect some kind of change. And if we don't believe in racism and we have a problem with it, then we can ask the companies that we engage with, that we buy things from, to make the same call, because it's something that we care about, and it's something that we feel like they should care about. So there are a lot of different ways to do things, and marches certainly are very effective in their own way. This is just something that we're choosing to do in this way.
And David, I wanted to ask you about a comment that Shannon made, which I thought was interesting, about the idea of that we need some discipline imposed on the sort of Wild West internet, social media. How do you respond to that, just from a sort of free expression, free speech perspective?
Yeah, I think that it is a widely shared view that the internet has just become a cesspool, and Twitter, maybe in particular, has become a cesspool, and it's a place where viewpoints that the vast majority of Americans wholeheartedly disagree with get a lot of air. I wanted to piggyback on something that Matt said, because I think it's important. He said that, you know, consumerism is what a lot of people have, and it's the weapon that they can wield. That's not what Matt said, but I'm putting words in his mouth, perhaps. I think one of the things that these campaigns highlight is the extreme polarization in our country and in the kind of siloization of political viewpoints. People feel powerless in many parts of our country, powerless in having an effect on the political process in the conventional ways. So it's likely that you live in an area where your legislator, your representative, either in the state house or in Congress, agrees with you. You're not going to change their mind. If you have something to say about Donald Trump or his policies or whomever, who do you turn to? We live in areas where our representatives kind of mirror our views in ways that are, I think, much greater than they have been in the past. And so I think, especially with Trump, who has elicited such a strong reaction from so many people, and I think for many good reasons, people don't feel that the ordinary channels of political protest, of political appeal to your political leaders, work anymore, or at least they don't feel effective. And here right in front of them is a way to have sort of an immediate impact, not only to have to be able to attack with words viewpoints that you disagree with, but to actually have a monetary impact on the platforms that you disagree with or particular speakers on those platforms. And that's immensely powerful anyway, but I think it's made all the more powerful because so many people in this country live in these kind of ideological bubbles where they don't feel that they can have any direct impact on the way the political process is working, at least not in the conventional kind of First Amendment ways.
So it's kind of a function of our locked-in tribal politics that people are seeking this this outlet. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Our guests tonight are Shannon Coulter, co-founder of Grab Your Wallet, Matt Rivets, founder of Sleeping Giants, and David Snyder, executive director of the First Amendment Coalition. We'd love to hear your questions or comments. You can dial in to join this conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or Facebook page. And, of course, you can also reach us on Twitter by using at cityvisions, KALW. Well, let's go back to the phone lines. We have William calling in from Belvedere. William, welcome to City Visions.
Yes, thank you very much. And I'm very glad that you're taking comments with respect to cable television news stations as well, so-called news stations. Many people, including me, object to the bias, what we regard as bias, of Fox. And so what many of my friends are doing is we simply contact the advertisers on Fox, the major advertisers. Their emails are available on the web if you go to their website, and tell them we don't like you advertising on Fox. And one thing that corporations they do not want you not to like them. They would like you to like them. And so if you indicate that you're dissatisfied with them advertising on Fox, then hopefully it'll influence them to put their money someplace else. You may remember that when O'Reilly had his, his sexual whatever, that Mercedes-Benz withdrew its advertising from Fox because of public outcry. And when, Ivanka Trump's line of clothes is out of business because the stores, they don't care one way or another about Donald Trump.
Well, that's our guest Shannon, who helped bring about that outcome.
Okay, people simply said, the store said, well, hold it. If we're associated with Ivanka Trump because it's Trump, then people will choose to shop someplace else. If you can get economics on your side, mm-hmm. you're three quarters of the way there. And many people say, well, I don't use that such product or whatever. It doesn't matter. The corporations don't know whether you use that product or whether you're contemplating using it. If you just contact them and say, Fox is terribly biased, then they'll take that into consideration.
William, it's a good point about the bottom line being a powerful motivator.
In our society, it's.
And Matt, you have experienced this on the online side in terms of cable
TV. Actually, on the Fox
News.
Side.
Yeah. Tell us about what's happening with you and Fox News.
Well, Fox has been, over the last 2 years, gotten progressively more and more racist. And you can see that on a lot of the opinion shows. Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham are two of the worst offenders. And they really have made that a feature, not a bug of their show. And so we've done – it's funny that he brought that up because with O'Reilly, we just asked – again, we're just asking these advertisers if they believe in this kind of stuff. So for the last – with Bill O'Reilly, there are a lot of female-centered brands that are advertising in his show. So do you want to support someone that had – $32 million of sexual harassment suits? You got to throw that out there and ask them. Same thing with Tucker Carlson. He, has these long screeds that are very anti-diversity and inclusion. And the majority of the advertisers that are on his show have pages on their websites dedicated to diversity and inclusion. So if you draw the line between those two and you just ask them the question, how can you then support, if you truly believe in this, how can you support this show with your money? And I hand him over a check every week. then a lot of the times they see that that really isn't something that they want to support. And, you know, for us, I think that those messages of the anti-immigrant, anti-women, there have been, over the last 2 weeks, has gotten progressively worse. Just in those last 2 weeks, you're seeing advertisers pull away one by one because it's just not something they want to support. And there's really no regulator on that. There's no one at Fox that is raising their hand and saying, hey, we think we can have a good political discussion without vilifying minorities or immigrants or women.
And Shannon, let me ask you a similar question from William. We just heard from Belvedere about cable TV news. What is your sort of next phase of your consumer boycott?
Yeah, I get asked multiple times a day, every day, whether or not we're going to boycott Fox News advertisers. And I completely understand people's desire to do that. It's not something that Grab Your Wallet will be involved in overtly. We did get a little bit active on that when Sean Hannity was disseminating the conspiracy theory about Seth Rich being murdered by the Democratic Party. So for me, it crosses the line into unacceptable once, you know, outright untruths. Debunked conspiracy theories and lies are actually being disseminated through a news network. That's my line. I think that to David's marketplace of ideas concept, Fox News may not be a platform that I agree with most of the time, and I do find a lot of what they say racist and offensive. But I'm not willing to boycott them based on that. I think that they're entitled to their racist, awful opinions.
And I wanted to ask both of you about your the blowback that you've gotten from this. So maybe starting with maybe threats of litigation. Matt, Breitbart has threatened to sue you. Can you describe what's going on with that?
We got a letter from Breitbart 2 months ago saying that they to prepare for a lawsuit and to preserve any and all documents between me and 1,000 different people, including a charter school that my dad helped found. It was ridiculous. And so I was fortunate. I got a really great attorney pro bono that sent them a really nice letter back saying, if that's something that you're willing to pursue, then you need to preserve all of your documentation between you and the Mercer family who funds you and anyone, and also all of their emails as well. So they have not contacted me since. Really, Sleeping Giants was an anonymous campaign for a year and a half. And just last summer, the Daily Caller, which is owned by Tucker Carlson or started by Tucker Carlson, decided that they were going to expose me and my identity. And they sort of pulled some strings and figured it out. And my family and I were subjected to death threats for a month afterwards, and still get some every now and again. But my kids were threatened with death, and that's, you know, unfortunately, that's if you express your opinion in a certain way, that's that truly is chilling free speech to me. But it's something that I wasn't willing to back off from.
And has this really changed you in terms of getting these kinds of threats and being exposed like that? I mean, has that changed your daily life?
Yeah, I mean, death threats aren't like my first choice of things to get. I mean, I certainly don't relish the idea of getting them. But at the same time, you kind of have to, if you stop what you're doing based on that, then I think that it's they're sort of getting what they want out of it, which is for you to stop, you know, raising these questions. And that, to me, that's a free expression or free speech issue, and I'm not willing to back down on it. And yeah, it definitely changes you a bit, but at the same time makes you stronger, and you know, you just kind of move on from there.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that you've gotten those threats, but I appreciate your resiliency about it. Shannon, same question for you. What happened? Was there litigation? What kind of blowback did you get? What kind of personal toll did it take to be out in front on these campaigns?
A heavy one, but it's hard to distinguish the toll that Donald Trump himself and his team and his administration have taken, and the toll that the blowback from Grab Your Wallet took, because they're all sort of merged together. I think a lot of people, a lot of women in particular, for the last 2 years have been feeling that toll really deeply. So for me, Grab Your Wallet, even though I was getting death threats as well, we haven't had any lawsuits, you know, knock on wood, yet. But the death threats and the threats and the angry emails that I get every day, feel like the price that I'm willing to pay for what we're doing. And I always turn to the community of people that has sprung up around this and feel deep solidarity with doing this with them. And so that's sort of where I turn when that happens.
Sort of in the bunker.
I turned to Shannon, by the way, when it started happening to me. She was the first person I called because she's gone through it. She talked me down pretty well.
Matt's the only one who understands my life.
Well, you guys are both in a pretty unique bunker together, it sounds like. So an interesting email here from Leanne, who asks, since your topic is Twitter activism, what about Twitter itself and their refusal to pay millions in San Francisco city payroll taxes that could go to seriously needed city resources, housing for the homeless, for starters? And I should also add, they give a platform to elected leaders who say some pretty hateful things. Sounds kind of ironic, I guess, but could you use Twitter to boycott some of Twitter's practices? Or is that something you've considered or people asked you about?
Well, the Black Party 500 that happened over the summer was a kind of a first-time use of Twitter in this sense, where we blocked Twitter's major advertisers, 80,000 people, using a tool called Block Together that was made by a guy from the EFF. It was fantastic, and nobody had ever done it before, and it helped to get Alex Jones off the platform. And a lot of people, I think, are very interested in calling tech companies out in particular about their, enforcing their terms of service. Like Matt keeps saying, it's all there in black and white in their terms of service. We believe in diversity and inclusion and respect and kindness. And, it's a very different story when it comes to actually enforcing those. So sometimes we have to give these tech companies a nudge.
And Matt, same question about Twitter. Do you get inquiries?
Yeah, I wish they'd pay city taxes. That'd be great. It has very little to do with what I'm doing, but I've been harshly critical of Twitter. They have those terms of service, and it takes a significant voice for them to do much of anything, and they're pretty tone deaf about how. Probably with taxes, but also in how they deal with offenses on their site. It was when Sleeping Giant started, it was a cesspool across the board. It's gotten a little bit better, and they've done a little bit better job. But we've had multiple times when we've had to call them out for leaving someone's address up there and for them getting death threats, and they're not very quick in doing that, and they're not very quick to make a wholesale move in anything, which is. That's a whole other issue.
Is there a better social media platform in terms of enforcing these?
No.
No. They're all equally
bad.
They're all terrible in their own way. They're all bad in enforcing their terms of service across the board. They will not and they don't – they're not receptive to even the people that use them every day. And so they are operating purely on their own on their own vision of what the world should look like, and that does not mean that the rest of us need to share that.
Well, let me go back to David Snyder, Executive Director of the First Amendment Coalition. So, David, where do you see these trends going towards? I mean, there's some concern just as we deal with the viability of printed media, newspapers and magazines. We just saw East Bay Express lay off most of their staff. What is the sort of the trend here taking us? Where do you see this all going?
God only knows. I mean, it's this world changes from day to day and week to week. But I do think we can boil down a couple of basic trends that have affected the way journalists do what they do and the way we all express ourselves. And the first is the decline of the traditional journalism outlets of old, the daily newspaper that shows up on your doorstep. It's clear that model, at least in some markets, really doesn't work. And I think that has some profound effects that we really have not seen yet, but I think will trickle down maybe slowly over time, particularly in small media markets, regional papers, small local papers. The function that those served in terms of being the watchdog for local governments, that has largely gone away. And so I think we're going to see an increase in corruption at the local level. There's nobody minding the store in many of these cities and even mid and even large-ish sized cities. So that's one trend. And the second trend is just this explosion of everyone's ability to say anything they want at any hour and reach potentially millions of people. That's really amazing. I mean, every now and then I step back and take stock of how far the ability of just an average person who has access to the internet, and that's an important qualifier, their ability to speak potentially to an audience of millions instantaneously really is remarkable, but it has raised a whole host of problems and conundrums that I think the greatest legal mind with a training in the First Amendment wouldn't be able to answer, at least not quickly. I mean, what is the standard? What are the standards on Twitter and Facebook? In theory, they're the whatever standards those private entities decide to set for themselves. But as Matt points out, those standards are often not applied uniformly or not applied at all. Do you apply a First Amendment standard on those platforms? I think almost everyone would find that standard unacceptable because hate speech is protected under the First Amendment. The government cannot bar what I think most people conventionally think of as hate speech. I think the standards that the First Amendment allows are far broader than what most people expect to see on social media platforms, and that's all to the good. The platforms can decide what they want to have on them for themselves. But how do those standards get applied and when and to whom? And I have no idea what the answer to that question is.
Lots of tricky issues here to try to sort through, and I think you're doing a good job in surfacing them. And I want to just let Matt and Shannon have a final word here. I wanted to ask them, maybe Matt, I'll start with you. What's next for your movement?
I think it's hard to really say. Every day is a bit different. Again, I think each day you wake up and something else horrendous will happen, and you feel like you have to deal with it. I just hope my deep desire is for companies to start to uniformly have an opinion that sort of goes across the board from their partnerships to their advertising to everything else to their employment. If you're going to champion diversity and inclusion, then champion it across the board. And so that's hopefully where this thing is going and hopefully where the business world is going.
And Shannon, same question for you. What's next for your movement?
Yes, having assembled inadvertently a large, well-motivated group of big-hearted, fair-minded consumers, I would really like to end workplace sexual harassment. And I think that that is entirely within our ability to do. We started a nonprofit around this and are meeting with foundations about funding it. But whether it gets funded or not, I'm gonna do it.
And you see a role for Twitter activism being part of that?
You know, it's funny. We keep talking about it being a Twitter movement, but actually thousands and thousands and thousands of people who participated in this aren't on Twitter at all. They don't have a Twitter account. They email and call these department stores. So there are a lot of people who are engaged with companies who aren't on social media. They just read about it in the news. But journalism played a huge role in propagating this movement. So, mm-hmm.
And is that a next step as well for you, Matt, kind of thinking beyond social media?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this thing has operated solely on Twitter and Facebook. But again, I think we have similar experience. There are a lot of people that are emailing and calling, and there are a lot of people that are engaged. We've got a huge community, and it's international now. We've got feeds in 11 countries and territories. So people want to take on hate where it is, and that's the idea, is to keep it going. And whether that's online or off, we hope that it continues, certainly.
All right. Well, I hope to have you both on in a year or so and see what else is on tap and how your movements have transformed. We're going to have to leave it there. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Shannon Coulter, co-founder of Grab Your Wallet. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Matt Rivets, founder of Sleeping Giants.
Thanks so much.
And also thank you to David Snyder, executive director of the First Amendment Coalition.
Thank you so much.
And thanks, of course, to all of you for joining us this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, let us know what you thought about tonight's program. And to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David La Tulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Grace Wan. Join us in 2 weeks. We're going to be off for the holiday next week for Martin Luther King, but we'll be back on the air in 2 weeks, and we hope you can tune in. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening.
Of the United